Tom Young, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. How you doing?
Thanks, Jason. Great to see you again. I certainly appreciate the chance to talk with you and your listeners about my new World War II novel coming out.
Now, I'm excited for it. You know, the greatest thing with Tom is he is very, very gracious, and he's very kind, because the past few days we've had to reschedule this four times because my power's been out. So I appreciate it, man.
Oh, no problem. I certainly appreciate the interest and the chance to chat with you. Yeah, we've had some challenging weather here in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, you know, once, I swear, if it thinks of snowing here, everything closes. But then when we actually get a storm, everything really closes.
Oh,
and then
yeah,
it closes for days on after that.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, one of the reasons I like having you on is because, well, for one, thrillers and fiction books, I love them. Can never have enough of them. But the thing is, you have a diverse background. It brings kind of your characteristics and your background into your books. Now, you've flown numerous combat missions throughout everywhere. You've logged 5,000 hours up in the air. But let's go back and let's find out, where did you come from and how did you get into the flying field? Did you always want to be in aviation?
That's a good question. I've always had an interest in it. I grew up on a farm in North Carolina, and I grew up listening to my grandfather's stories from World War II. He was a mechanic on B-17s, and I was just enthralled by his stories, and that fired my interest in aviation. But I always also had an interest in writing and in journalism. And when I first started college at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, I was torn between a military aviation career and a journalism career. And in my youthful ignorance, I thought I had to choose one or the other and never look back. So for a long time, I pursued journalism and writing pretty single-mindedly. And then it dawned on me that, hey, I could join a reserve component of the military and have my cake and eat it too. I can have my civilian career and also serve in the military. And that's why I joined the Air National Guard.
Yeah, I was muted. Hey, welcome to the Professional Protectors Podcast. Hey, Tom, you mentioned one thing about having your cake and eating it too. And then, you know, checking your background out, you know, working for the Associated Press in a broadcast division, that's something else I also wanted to talk to you about, is what's it like working for the press, you know, and coming from the military, the press and everything? It's kind of interesting dynamic.
It's definitely two very different fields. Working for the Associated Press is it can be quite hectic. It does burn people out, but you have the satisfaction of knowing you're working for a great news organization. But I know a lot of people who work for the AP for a number of years. I was there for 10 years, but they didn't stay for an entire career. This may sound like a strange comparison, but I would compare it to a financial person working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. It's hectic. It's exciting. You're in the middle of the action and you learn a lot. But not everybody does that for 30 years. And people go on and do other things. And I was interested in writing fiction, and I wound up getting to do that as well. Just to give you a little quick background story about why I joined the Guard. I remember I was still at the AP in the early 90s during the first Gulf War. And we did a lot of stories then about what I thought were these interesting people who had civilian careers and were also in the Guard and Reserve, and they were getting called up. And one of them, one of the stories was about a television reporter in Louisiana who also flew for the Air Force Reserve. And I thought, well, heck, that's a journalist who flies. If he can do that, I can do that too.
No, that's a great idea, because, you know, Rob Riggle's another famous veteran who was a reservist who kept his career going while he still served and while he's still deployed. So you can do it. And that's why, you know, if I still had the bandwidth, I would might still be in the Guard reserves or something along those lines. But, you know, at this point in my life, almost at that 50, I'm like, yeah, you know, I think I'll sit back and podcast and write. And you've written a lot of thriller books, plus a nonfiction book. What got you into the genre, and what was this something you always wanted to do?
I always wanted to write fiction of some kind. And it was just my life experiences that led me into thrillers, into military related fiction. I grew up in the South. I love Southern fiction. And when I studied fiction writing in college, I gravitated toward the Southern writers. Of course, my writing is not anything, you wouldn't call it Southern literature, but I'm a big fan of that genre. But then my experiences in the military just kind of led me toward military related thrillers. For the longest time, I wanted to write a novel, but I didn't have a good story idea that I could really sink my teeth into until my unit got activated after 9/11 and we started flying in and out of Afghanistan and then later into Iraq. And then that gave me plenty of material, to say the least. So that's what led me into military fiction. And I'd always had a fascination with World War II, beginning with my grandfather's stories. And that's why I eventually transitioned from thrillers set in the present day to historical fiction set in World War II.
I love it. I love history. I love, you know, anything that has to do with World War II, World War I, Vietnam. Obviously, this is, you know, I'm not going back too far. But, you know, there's so much to write about and so much to intercede into them, because these conflicts did go on for a while. And there were so many heroes in those conflicts. And you could say so many villains. So you do have a lot of protagonists and you have a lot of antagonists. Now, your book coming up is Red Burning Sky, and that's coming out on February 22nd, and looking forward to it. So let's talk about that. You said you had, you know, a background on it and how you got involved in this one. This sounds like a really cool one.
Well, thank you. Red Burning Sky is based on a real life event from World War II, something called Operation Halyard, that's spelled H-A-L-Y-A-R-D. And Operation Halyard was the rescue of more than 500 downed American flyers in Yugoslavia, mainly in 1944. And it's one of the lesser known corners of World War II history. In fact, I often refer to it as the greatest military rescue you've never heard of. I find that there are even some World War II buffs who haven't heard of this one. And if you haven't, don't feel bad, because there's some reasons why it was kept under wraps even after the war. And we can get into that in a little bit if you like. But I just thought this was a fascinating story. And the way I ran across it was I got interested in operations by the forerunner of the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services. And I just started Googling OSS operations, and Operation Halyard is one of the things that came up. And the more I read about it, the more I was interested in it. It was just such a terrific rescue, a terrific airlift operation. And I'm an old airlifter. I was a flight engineer on C-130s and C-5s. So that's why it particularly interested me.
So then putting it all together, and how do you research something like that? Are you doing, you know, obviously it's going to be fiction, so you can kind of come up with your own storylines, but a lot of your work is based on reality. So how do you go about doing this? Do you go and you interview people? Do you just do book research, internet research, and try to keep it as valid as possible?
All of the above. For the historical background, usually I read books and find articles online. For the technical background, for example, describing the scenes in Red Burning Sky where these rescue pilots are flying C-47s, it's a military version of the DC-3, there's a lot of terrific resources on YouTube, of all places. But someone, probably several someones, has done us writers a great favor by uploading to YouTube a lot of training films from World War II. So if you want to, you can find on YouTube the training film that a new C-47 pilot would have been shown about how to fly that thing. And that gives me some technical detail to rely on. Of course, you apply that with light brushstrokes. You don't want to get too deep in the technical details, but that's where I get that kind of thing. And I do interview people as well. I find that no matter how interested I get in, say, the C-47 aircraft or the M1 rifle or whatever, there's always somebody out there who knows more about it than I do. And I try to find those people and talk with them, and they're quite helpful as well. Some of the living history organizations that fly World War II aircraft have been quite helpful, like the Commemorative Air Force, other organizations like that. I call them up and say, you know, hey, you fly one of these things, tell me about it.
Now, have you gone up in the air with some of these old historic planes?
A little bit. Just recently, back in October, I had the honor of riding in the Delaware Aviation Museum's B-25 Mitchell, an aircraft called Panchito. They were kind enough to invite me up in the B-25, and it was a delight to fly with those folks. Other than that, I've toured B-17s and B-29s and things like that that were on static display on the ground. But apart from the B-25 ride, the nearest I've ever come to flying an old warbird is some time I put in a T-34 Mentor, and that was a lot of fun.
What's it like compared to, like, you know, you've been in a C-5 and C-130 world for a long time. What's it like getting into these antiquated or antique type aircraft?
You know, the thing that strikes you when you climb aboard something like a B-25 is the dedication that the crews had to have had. And what I mean by that is the discomfort they would have had to endure to do their missions even before they ever start getting shot at. For example, the B-25, if you're the tail gunner in that thing, there's a narrow passageway you have to crawl through. And then you're back there in that greenhouse that enclosed the tail gunner. That had to have been miserably hot in the summertime and bitterly cold in the winter. This thing was not pressurized. And I don't imagine there was a whole lot of heat back there in the wintertime. And just the toughness that these guys must have had just to fly the darn thing at all, let alone succeed in combat.
Yeah, you know, Christmas just passed and, you know, It's a Wonderful Life is always out. And they've, you know, you could tell, you know, and everybody, Jimmy Stewart, James Stewart for you youngsters, was a famous actor. It's in A Wonderful Life. And he flew combat missions beyond combat missions after he became an actor. And when you watch that movie, you could see his PTS. Oh, and yeah. You wonder, like, let's talk about that and what these old flyers must have gone through compared to, like, you know, there's a lot of countermeasures now in the modern. And yes, it's still you can have some harrowing experiences. But can you imagine, like, the World War II pilots?
Oh, yes. I remember my grandfather's stories about the early days when the 8th Air Force deployed to England and the terrible losses they would have. When I was a kid, a light aircraft crashed in the woods not far from our farm. And my grandfather and I went to see the aftermath after the ambulance had come. And the wreckage was, you know, not a pleasant sight to see. And there was blood in the wreckage. And as an adult, I probably wouldn't have asked this question. But as a kid, I didn't know any better. And I just blurted out, did you see much of this during the war? And he said, every day.
Yeah, it's like every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think about, like, the World War II flyers. And that's the thing about, I think eventually Jimmy Stewart had to be pulled from the flight line because he just saw too much.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, you're constantly under fire. Your friends are dying all the time. And you're flying all the time. And it's just constant bombardment. And you just don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. It's what they endured is hard for us to imagine, even those of us who had a little taste of combat ourselves. One of my grandfather's most striking stories involved marshaling an aircraft back in after a mission. As I mentioned, he was a mechanic. He was a ground crewman. But even in that role, he saw quite a bit. And as the aircraft flew the downwind leg to come in and land, it fired flares, which was a signal that meant wounded aboard. The plane landed safely. And as the plane is taxiing up to his hard stand and he's marshaling it in, you know, the way a ground crewman does, he sees that the aircraft is leaking fluid. Well, he's a mechanic. He's thinking, is that oil? Is that hydraulic fluid? What have I got to fix? Plane shuts down its engines and he moves forward to open the waste doors. And he sees that it's not oil or hydraulic fluid. The aircraft itself is dripping blood.
Wow.
Because so many of the crew members have been wounded.
Just, you know, in those holes, you know, when I was talking about the C-5 and the C-130 compared to the old planes, it's almost like the old planes were like papier-mâché compared to what we have nowadays.
Oh, yes. It, at least in the well, for example, in the C-130, when we were flying in combat zones, we could put armor in strategic places in the flight deck, on the floor, and so forth, and on the sides. And you're wearing your own flight vest, and you feel somewhat protected. They had some of that in World War II, but they were a lot more exposed than we were. And then, of course, they were under a lot more fire than we were too.
You know, when you talk about the C-130 in combat, small arms fire can puncture the hull and ignite, I'd imagine, the fuel cells. But how much fuel is really in there, and how much? Let's talk about that. That's what I'm always interested to talk about, C-130s, because I got to fly in a bunch of them. But what is that like to be in a C-130 in combat? Obviously, you know, I flew in and out of Iraq and stuff. But when you're talking like Afghanistan, you've been all over the world a lot. So let's talk about the differences in taking off in combat compared to not combat.
Well, there are certain procedures you use in combat to try to make yourself a difficult target. And small arms fire is not your biggest worry. I mean, it would take a really lucky shot for small arms fire to do a lot of damage. You would have to be pretty unlucky to have a round hit you. I mean, it's been known to happen, but small arms fire is not your biggest concern. You're more concerned with man pads, with shoulder-fired heat-seeking missiles. And there are countermeasures for that. That's something that they didn't have to deal with in World War II. But whenever I was deployed and flying with my crew in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, between the countermeasures and our training for defensive procedures, I felt pretty confident. I was confident in our training, and I thought as long as we stay on top of our game, we're probably going to be all right. And indeed, we were. But if you'd been flying a B-17 over Germany in World War II, you couldn't make that assumption, because there was so much anti-aircraft artillery coming up and so many enemy fighters coming after you. You just had to know that the odds were a lot worse.
So the next book's coming up, and you have to be excited. And this is obviously we're kind of in this weird COVID state. Are you going to be doing a lot of virtual signings, a lot of any of appearances? And you're still flying, right?
Yes, I'm still flying. I'm an airline pilot, and so I still have a day job. But this time, because the COVID situation is not as bad as it was when my last book came out, I do have some in-person events and a lot of virtual events too. But this year, I think in-person events are going to be a little bit more feasible. And I'll be posting the schedule for that stuff on my website, tomyoungbooks.com. And that stuff will start around the week of the book release, week of February 22nd.
What do you want the audience? Oh, and the reason I asked you, you're still flying, I'm like, can you just like when you're flying and you're in your off time, can you just pop and do a book signing in the state you're flying to or anything else like that?
There's usually not time for that. Usually we're doing quick turns, or even if it's an overnight, there's not enough time to break away and do a book signing. So usually what I tend to do is I'll commit to a date to do a book signing. And then when I bid for my schedule with the airline, I'll just bid around that date and make sure I'm off during that time. It's a nice idea, though. I wish I could do that, but that would seldom be feasible.
Exactly. Now, what do you want the audience to expect from when they read your books? And do we have to go back? Is this going to be a standalone, or is this part of a series?
This one's a standalone. It's not part of a series. And I suppose the best takeaway for anyone reading Red Burning Sky would be what the Yugoslav people, what the Serbian guerrillas and villagers did to protect our downed airmen during World War II, what the downed airmen did to try to accomplish their mission, and some of the ingenious things they did to try to communicate with higher headquarters and say, hey, here we are, send some C-47s in to pick us up. And then the dedication and skill of the C-47 pilots. Operation Halyard was just a stunning success. In a nutshell, what happened was the OSS parachuted agents into that part of Yugoslavia to organize an effort to have the downed airmen, the guerrillas, and the local villagers build dirt airstrips by hand. so that C-47s could come in and land and pick these guys up. And this is in German-occupied territory. So they're picking these guys up right out from under the noses of the Germans. And they did it. They pulled it off. They built dirt airstrips with nothing but shovels and hose and axes. C-47s came in and picked them up over a series of months, flying shuttles in and out of there, flying them back to Italy. And they got them all. To my knowledge, they didn't leave anybody behind. To my knowledge, they didn't have any accidents. You can imagine what a disaster an accident would have been if a pilot had rolled a C-47 into a ball on one of these dirt airstrips. Not only would it have blocked the airstrip, but the smoke and the fire would have alerted the Germans. I mean, these guys just had no room for error. And they pulled it off because they didn't know they couldn't pull it off. I mean, they did it because they didn't realize it was supposed to be impossible. You know, I can tell you as an old airlifter myself, what they did with C-47s would be difficult even now with C-130s and night vision goggles, but they made it happen.
I tell you, I'm actually going to read this. I like the standalone books. I love aviation history. I every time I watch Band of Brothers, that first few episodes, like actually the, you know, two plus on, when they're getting ready and then when they're going into combat, you're just like, man, what did these World War II pilots and soldiers and sailors and airmen and everybody else up in there go? You know, it's just crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Tom, I appreciate you coming on the show. I'm looking forward to doing more collaboration, maybe with the book club and everything else.
I'd be honored. Thank you so much for your interest. And it's always a pleasure to chat with you. I certainly enjoyed it.
Everybody, make sure you head to Tom's website. It's tomyoungbooks.com. In there, you'll find links to his books and everything. And his book, Red Burning Sky, releases February 22nd, everywhere books are sold. Make sure, you know, give him a support. Give him a like. Head over. And when you buy the book, review the book. Authors need reviews. It really does help.
Yes.